This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We got to get to a most read story on the Bloomberg.
Okay, so what happens when we ask ChatGPT to make a market-beating ETF? Well,
you get a most read story on the Bloomberg. You also, I got to just say, Bloomberg, Sam Potter, and Katie Greifeld, they did have a chat with ChatGPT. And what they found out, well, we humans don't yet quite need to be worried that we're going to be replaced, at least not yet.
At least not yet. I think that's key. With more on what they did, how they did it, here's Sam Potter. He's senior editor and ETF czar here at Bloomberg News. Joining us via Zoom from London. Sam, first of all, congratulations. Brilliant idea here. One of those, like, why didn't I think of doing
exactly.
that? Because it's just so awesome.
I didn't think of it of doing it. It was actually our very own Matt Miller who came up with the idea.
It is so Matt Miller.
Love that.
It's sort of Matt Miller. And when we heard it, Kate and I thought, yeah, that is an idea that we're going to steal. So
Matt's probably asking a million questions, Sam. You know it. I can only imagine.
Okay, so what exactly did you ask ChatGPT, and what did it spit out to you?
It's sort of a thing going around the internet at the moment, isn't it, to come up with some hypothetical to test out this incredible AI tech. And in our line of work, I thought, let's try and see if this can give us an edge in making money. So we, you know, kept it pretty straightforward and just asked it to initially if it could create or design an ETF that would beat the US stock market and tell us what the ETF would hold. And it struggled, is the bottom line. Lots of caveats about knowing your investment risk and speaking to financial advisors and talk of how unpredictable the US stock market can be.
You know, it's funny, reading in on your story and Katie's story this morning, Sam, I did start to think, though, is there a point we could say, hey, can you compare these two? The Bloomberg kind of does this, right? You know, but you could see how you could use something like this where you could ask it a question, compare these two players in the space, you know, what looks more likely for revenue growth or who's got better metrics? Like, I do see where this could go, right, ultimately, or how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, for sure. And in a way, this is a version of what's already at work in so many funds. I mean, one thing we have in the story is a number of artificial intelligence powered ETFs or enhanced ETFs, which already exist and already are working. And beyond that, there's a lot of, in particular, quant shops who are deploying AI technology, and they're using it in very much that way, either to do swaths of fundamental analysis or perhaps to work through some more complicated and unusual data to try and extract sentiment or macro signals. So, I mean, the fundamentals of this are pretty sound, and it's quite scary how quickly it's moving along.
I was actually surprised to find that, you know, there already is, as you mentioned, there are ETFs that do this. AIEQ is one of those ETFs that you write about. But this uses Watson from IBM, Sam. What can you tell?
That's right.
And the performance has been, you know, pretty good.
Pretty good in the near term. It's over the course of its life. It's about 5 years old now, pushing 6 years, 5.5 years, I think. And it has underperformed the S&P 500 total return index. It's delivered about 42% over that time, and the total return index has delivered 72, I think. However, this year it's well up. It's more than twice the S&P 500 index. I think always an interesting one, which I like to come back and look to from time to time, because it moves quite quickly. It reacts quite fast. Even today, the top holdings have changed from yesterday. So it gives you a pretty good barometer of sentiment, at least what the machine thinks sentiment is doing. But really, its best performance came when it was backing the big tech giants in the bull market. And as we all know, you didn't need necessarily an AI machine to tell you to do that.
It's nothing like a good momentum play. Well, it does make me wonder too, Sam. You know, we always say past performance, no guarantee, basically, of future performance.
So does ChatGPT.
Right? Like, I get that. It doesn't matter. I mean, could we even get to a point, because nothing is a guarantee, right? And how does, you know, a bot, how does ChatGPT, you know, detect, or could it maybe detect those black swans, like the financial crisis? Could it have somehow figured out the over leverage in the fine, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Does it at some point have enough data to be that super smart?
I think, I mean, one of the limitations on this is definitely the data you're tapping. But the ChatGPT, one of the sort of caveats of it is that it doesn't have much uploaded into it from beyond 2021. Mm. So for our purposes, for, you know, markets which are moving every day, it's already actually, in truth, it's passing some pretty old data. I think most of the shops, the investment houses and funds that use this stuff, use it in conjunction with sort of human intel. There is still something about machine learning and artificial intelligence that you know, you can trick it. It can be fooled. It can make mistakes. In ways you don't necessarily, you know, you can't necessarily program it out. So I think the future is very much a sort of hybrid where people will deploy this stuff to get through great swaths of data, but then it will be humans who are kind of making the trading decision at the end of the day.
It's really fascinating. I feel like the reading some of the responses you got back from it is like a reminder of, like, you know, when you go through a prospectus, so like at the end, and it's all those little
disclosures
that you can barely read. It's like, hey, just remember, you know, nothing's a guarantee. Sam, thank you so much. We know it's late there in London, later, and we really appreciate it. Sam Potter, senior editor, ETF czar, joining us here on Bloomberg News. Joining us, as we said, via Zoom from London.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
I want to go back to wellness and health. It's something Tim and I spend a lot of time talking about, rightfully so, because there were some really interesting findings. They were out earlier this month, and it was about the link between hearing loss and dementia in older adults, Tim.
Yeah, so older adults who have severe hearing loss were more likely to have dementia, though the likelihood of dementia was actually lower among hearing aid users compared to those who don't use them. We're very lucky to have with us this afternoon one of the authors of the study, Allison Huang, Senior Research Associate at the Center for Hearing and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Allison joins us on the phone from Baltimore. Allison, good to have you with us this afternoon. So on a high level, take us through what you found in the study.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So in this study, we use a data set called the National Health and Aging Trends Study, which is a large nationally representative study of older Medicare beneficiaries in the United States over 65 years and older. And in the study that covers over 2,400 older adults, we find that for every 10 decibel increase in hearing loss, is associated with a 16% greater prevalence of dementia, such that having moderate or greater hearing loss is actually associated with a 61% greater prevalence of dementia compared to having normal hearing.
It makes sense.
And then we look.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No. Please continue.
Yeah, so then we also looked at hearing aid use. So among over 850 older adults with moderate or greater hearing loss, we found that hearing aid use was potentially beneficial and that dementia prevalence was 32% lower among those who used hearing aids.
So what is that telling us? Is that telling us that if you have a hard time hearing, it leads to changes within your brain that ultimately result in dementia? Am I making the wrong connection here?
Yeah, so in this study, we're not able to look at risk longitudinally. It is cross-sectional, so we're just seeing that in people with hearing loss, there's a higher prevalence of dementia. There's a higher likelihood of having dementia.
Doesn't it make sense? Like, I think about if you are increasingly, as an older individual, you know, if you can't hear, if you're locked out, like, I just feel like your stimulus, like, your body not being stimulated, like, things start to probably shut down, right?
Yeah. So that's, you know, one of the proposed mechanisms between hearing loss and dementia is through social isolation. And I've witnessed this, you know, within my own family, with grandparents who have hearing loss that, you know, tend to start to withdraw from conversations or participate less in social relationships or social activities. And that can really lead to a lot of social isolation, which is also a strong risk factor for dementia. We actually had a paper published from that same data set recently that showed that social isolation is associated with a 28% increased risk of dementia over 9 years. So that is one potential mechanism between hearing loss and dementia.
What are some other connections between this? It makes sense what Carol said with the idea of not necessarily
having... I feel
having...
like I've seen some of it firsthand, to be quite honest, with older individuals in my family, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, my grandfather at the end of his life had dementia. For anyone who's lived with a family member or experienced this with a family member, it's just awful.
Well, that's a good point, Tim, because, and I think, Allison, for all of us who've had older members in our family, I feel like doctors will say, well, everybody gets dementia as they get older, right? Uh-huh. It's just as the body is getting older and things aren't functioning as well. How much of it, though, could be not as severe because of hearing and popping in a hearing aid?
Right. And that's what we're trying to figure out. You know, hearing is such an important risk factor because it is modifiable through hearing aids. And, you know, there is the potential to possibly slow cognitive decline or even delay dementia. But that's one part of the question that we're still trying to figure out. And, you know, our findings from this study are encouraging, and they do support public health efforts to increase access to hearing aids. But we're not able to definitively test whether hearing aid use is effective for reducing dementia risk. We do need to randomize control trials for that.
Will you be able to do that?
Yeah, unfortunately. So we have the ACHIEVE trial, which is led by Drs. Frank Lin and Joseph Koresh here at Hopkins and funded by the National Institute of Aging. And that trial tests the effectiveness of a best practices hearing treatment with hearing aids versus a health education active control, and looks at changes in cognition over 3 years. Unfortunately, that trial just closed at the end of last month, and results will be available later this year.
Because I do wonder, okay, maybe this is just weird and out of left field, but, you know, kids who can't hear, right? I mean, and once you realize, like, is there ever kind of signs of something happening in their brain not functioning as well? I mean, they obviously sometimes speech is delayed. So I wonder, you know, something that, you know, then you find out and then you either get an implant or you get an aid or something, and then kids seem to pick up and get back on track. But I wonder, is there something developmentally at any age that we understand the importance of something like hearing?
Right. So one of the mechanisms, in addition to social isolation, is through something called cognitive load. Mm. So for people with hearing loss, when sound and speech come in, it's heard by the brain as garbled. And it takes the brain extra cognitive resources and extra cognitive effort to, you know, decipher this sound, to process this speech. And that takes cognitive resources and effort away from other cognitive functions like memory or executive function to the detriment of those cognitive functions. So that's one way that hearing loss can, you know, affect the cognitive part and a proposed mechanism between hearing loss and dementia. Another is actually through direct changes to the brain. So in older adults with hearing loss, the parts of the brain that are used to receiving auditory input, so used to be stimulated by sound and speech, are understimulated or no longer stimulated. Mm. And over time, that understimulation could lead to atrophy in those specific brain structures, which can also lead to dementia.
So for the layperson listening to this or seeing the results of this study, how should they think about it holistically with their own health?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I think really it highlights the importance of hearing to your overall cognitive health as well as your overall well-being. And I think one thing is to not consider hearing as just a normal part of, you know, getting older. It's really to be proactive in caring for your hearing and keeping track of your hearing.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And it's something to certainly think about because of the implications.
I think about this a lot for you and me, Carol, because we always have things in our ears, whether we're doing TV, whether we're doing radio, and
like how it impacts our hearing longer term.
That's just my own selfish take.
I know people are like, when they get into like the volumes that I put for our earphones and stuff, I keep it pretty loud.
You do?
I do.
Maybe watch that.
Yeah. Listen, Allison, we really appreciate it. It's important. And it's something that we, you know, Tim and I definitely love to get into kind of overall wellness and health for all generations. So really appreciate it. Allison Huang, she's Senior Research Associate, Center for Hearing and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies, joining us on the phone from Baltimore.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Talking about Tesla a lot today. Tesla shares are on a roll, just off their highs of the session, but still up about 9.5%. They did top above, again, that $500 billion market cap.
It's earlier in
the session.
It's getting there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just below it again, though.
So Elon Musk, also the subject of this week's cover story, which notes that if he has a tragic flaw, it isn't his temper or his treatment of underlings or his refusal to follow securities laws. Nope. It's that he's extremely and painfully unfunny.
Which is kind of funny.
That is kind of funny.
All right, so let's get to it. With us is Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Jafkin and Bloomberg News technology reporter Dana Hull. They wrote the story, the cover story of Businessweek. Max is here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Dana, on the phone from San Francisco. Nice timing, guys. This is what we are all leaning in on. Dana, I'm going to start with you because, you know, Elon, I always feel like, you know, that he, for a long time, could do no wrong to some extent, and everybody was all in, and then things changed. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, 2022 was sort of a remarkable year for him and for all of us in a lot of ways. But, I mean, you know, this is a guy who was Time and the FT's Man of the Year or Person of the Year for 2021. And then in 2022, he bought Twitter. And in order to buy Twitter, he sold billions of dollars worth of Tesla shares. And then once he took the reins at Twitter, he fired everybody and started to interact with a pretty, like, sort of rogues gallery of characters, you know, right-wing folks, anti-Semitic folks, conspiracy theorists, and, you know, for a long time, old-school early adopters of the Tesla brand, this was very, very alarming. And I think what you saw was that because Tesla and Elon are so intertwined, I mean, there is, like, the brands are the same, basically. There was a real erosion of the Tesla brand in marketing surveys, in just conversations with former employees, in conversations with potential EV buyers. And that was really something that Max and I wanted to explore at this kind of pivotal moment for the company.
Hey, Max, come on in here because I was, you know, I was having this conversation with a friend recently who has bought two Teslas. And I was saying, what do you think of all the stuff that Elon Musk does? And he was like, you know what? I don't care what this guy's a Musk fan, okay?
Yeah.
He's like, I don't care what the CEO of Disney does. I don't care what the CEO of, you know, these other companies. And I said, you know what though? But the thing is with Tesla and Musk, like the two are inextricably bound to one another.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about Tesla's brand, it's different from talking about Ford's brand or Chrysler's brand or something like that. As Dana was saying, that's there are two reasons for that. One is this kind of Musk as the centerpiece. You know, for years we talked about how amazing it was that, you know, Tesla Tesla didn't spend money on advertising. I mean, it's been a big, huge part of the way this company finds people. And then the second thing is it's still a very strong brand. Musk is doing things that are hurting the company, and that sort of, as Dana said, like longtime investors, some longtime fans have found uncomfortable. But it's not like there aren't fans. And yesterday, while we were listening to the earnings, right, Tesla put the numbers out. They're sort of okay. There was a sort of beat on revenue, and it's kind of a mixed bag, and the markets weren't doing anything. And then Musk gets up during the call and says, we said we're going to make 1.8 million cars, but we just might make 2 million cars, And the stock went berserk at that point. And that's where it had this huge jump. And so the thing is, when Musk still does kind of like the Musk thing, which is, talk about how great Tesla is and how many cars they're going to make and make these like wild
promises. No demand problem. No demand problem.
Investors like that. They're still going for it. It's when he starts talking to Cat Turd, to pick on one of his, interlocutors on Twitter, that people start to feel uncomfortable. So it's not like he can't walk back from this. It's not like he can't come back from some of this damage. But there has been a shift, and it's reflected in the stock price. Even though it's gone up today, it's still half of what it was, worse than half what it was, before this Twitter stuff started.
Dan, it is kind of remarkable, some of the things that he does and some of the investigations that are happening. He was up on, this whole week, right, on the witness stand talking. This is not typically what you want of a CEO of a publicly held company. Does he not get it? Like, what is it about Elon? Like, he's got to be seeing the headlines, the news. He's got to see the stock drop. Does he not understand that some of these things he does is not so good?
I mean, Elon reads everything about himself. I mean, I think he probably gets notifications for himself on Twitter. He read our story. He read our cover story. But I think that he's gotten whatever his shtick is, he has gotten away with it for a very long time, and it works for him in the way that it works for President Trump. I mean, like him or hate him, people see him as an unvarnished, authentic character. I mean, he says what he thinks. Sometimes he's rude. He called like the public county health officials fascists on earnings calls. He told analysts that their questions were boring and boneheaded. He thinks that Joe Biden is a damp sock puppet. I mean, he says what he thinks, and people like that. They like that authenticity. They respond to that. And it keeps him in the news, and it keeps him in the conversation. And even if he's in the conversation for bad reasons, he's still in the conversation. I mean, I think if you interviewed a bunch of people on the streets of Manhattan and asked them, who's the current CEO of GM, Ford, Fiat Chrysler, or BMW? Like, I don't know if they would know who it was. But, like, people know who Elon Musk is, and that helps. Ultimately, I think it helps him.
Hey, Max, to that end, and what Dana was talking about, it doesn't always go well for Elon Musk. What happened at a Dave Chappelle show recently?
Oh yeah, this was the way we opened the story, and it was, I think, Dana's idea, just because it was such a contrast from kind of the response that Musk normally gets when he's in front of a crowd. He gets up there, Dave Chappelle, performance in San Francisco, sold out crowd, giant arena show. Dave Chappelle, of course, is a controversial comedian. A lot of his act is about, railing on, the dangers of woke culture and things like that. In other words, these are people who you would think would be fans of Musk's kind of right-wing, transgressive Twitter stuff. And they weren't. They were booing him. And just seeing that kind of turn, I mean, that's where we got the idea to write the story, because just like seeing that turn was pretty dramatic. And Musk has a big fan base. They love him, just as Dan is saying. On the other hand, it's not clear how much more growth Tesla has. They need to grow to be so much bigger to justify the current valuation.
Danny, you did say he read the story. Did he respond to you guys? Wait.
I'll let Max take
go ahead.
I think I can.
Quite a response. I mean, well, it wasn't like a direct response, but he, like, someone quote tweeted it, and then go ahead, Max. You want to read it?
Musk was talking about the story with like a handful of like Dogecoin influencers. Dogecoin being the
of course.
His favorite cryptocurrency, and they were kind of saying like, "No, you really are funny, Elon," and he was responding like, "Thank you." So not exactly a direct response, but certainly talking about it. And then on the earnings call, there was a very very interesting moment where an investor asked, you know, what, you know, about the sort of potential brand damage, citing a poll that we cited by YouGov, which is a, you know, scientific pollster. And Musk essentially said, you know, YouGov schmoogov, I got 127 million Twitter followers. And it was a really interesting moment because, first of all, a little bit of a window into what his strategy is, or, yeah, you know, if you're trying to find a strategy with Twitter, it's like, hey, I'm out there, I'm in the news, just like Dana said, people are talking about it, so it must be good. It also was a bit of a turnabout from the way Musk was talking about Twitter, you know, several months ago, when it was just like, oh, these followers are fake, you can't trust them, and so on. So super interesting moment, and I read that also as a response to the story.
Well, it's an incredible story. We've run out of time. We could talk forever on it. It does make me wonder, God, if he didn't buy Twitter, would we still be, I don't know, where would we be? But who knows? Guys, we got to run. Cover story of Bloomberg Business Week. It's a killer. Bloomberg Business Week columnist Max Chaffman and Bloomberg News Technology reporter Dana Hull, they wrote it. So check it out, the new issue on newsstands, online, and on the Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Keep driving crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, getting ready to count down to the close.
Are you ready? Are you getting ready? These couple hours flew today. It usually flies, but I mean, we're what, you know, 17 minutes from the close.
Time flies when you're having fun.
It does.
We're off our worst and best levels of the day, but we're getting ready for some big earnings after the close. But it does feel like that risk on sentiment continues to really drive the equity trade higher.
It's puzzling to me.
Yeah.
But why? Maybe it's not puzzling to Aaron.
Because the economic news?
Yeah.
Right.
But you know what? Maybe that's why I do this instead of run money for a living. Who knows? Aaron Cannon is the co-founder and CEO of Clear Harbor Asset Management. They've got over $1 billion in assets under management. He joins us this afternoon via Zoom from Stamford, Connecticut. Aaron, happy new year. We haven't had you on in a few weeks, so I think I'm still allowed to say that. How are you?
Doing just fine. Thanks for having me back, Tim and Carol.
Well, year to date, the S&P 500 is up 5.5%. The NASDAQ composite up close to 10% already. Are markets getting ahead of themselves?
Well, certainly technicals have improved, as you just alluded to. You know, whether it's the advanced decline lines or 200-day moving averages, I think the market is trying to peer through the next set of steps on the liquidity side, specifically how the Fed is going to respond. I think 25 basis points at the next meeting is sort of somewhat cooked in the books, as they say. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you look at COVID too, it was all about liquidity. We had a massive inflow of liquidity during a period of great economic uncertainty, and equity markets rocked higher and PE multiples expanded. And now we're at the sort of point where liquidity may be returning again after the Fed started tightening last year, somewhat massively. So that liquidity may be returning in the back half of this year, and I think the markets are perhaps thinking about getting ahead of it.
Hey, Aaron, do you think this is a market that's trading like a possible recession might be coming?
I think the market is of the view that we're either in a sort of zero growth environment. We could be possibly slightly negative, slightly positive at this moment. Now, of course, we saw Q4 GDP this morning. It was quite positive, but positive on the heels of a lot of inventory rebuilds. I don't think the market's prepared for a significant earnings recession. You know, if you look at sort of where the market is right now at 4,065 or so on the S&P 500 and $233 of anticipated earnings by the average analyst estimates at the beginning of this year, it's at 17 and a half times multiple. That's, you know, well above the 25-year average that we have seen. So if we go into a 10% recession from, let's say, $221 of full year earnings in 2021, you know, I'm not sure which multiple you put on that, but I don't think you put 17 and a half times. You probably put something closer to 15, and you're at 3,000. That's not my base case, but if you really believe in a deeper sort of earnings recession, I think you have to start thinking that maybe we're at the upper end of a range here for the S&P 500.
What is your base case?
I think we probably skate along at the sort of zero growth bound, and perhaps we start to see the Fed become much more accommodative in the back half of the year. We see a return of liquidity, but we see economic conditions continue to sort of deteriorate. You know, I think if you look at the economy prior to 2022, which was not a great year for the market, and you look at the 10 years prior to that, you know, we had GDP growth probably accrue heavily to the markets, to capital. And I just, you know, sort of think about what happened during COVID. Now you have reticence on the part of employers to fire, even as they're seeing a bit of an economic slowdown. And it makes me wonder whether or not the next several years of GDP growth will accrue more towards labor, will accrue more towards the real economy rather than to markets. And so something we're thinking about here, could we be in a position where we go into sort of a weaker economic picture, but employment remains on the margin a little stronger than we expect relative to the data points?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that, Aaron, this possibility of having somewhat of a recession here in the United States, and yet the job market is still doing okay, if you will, which would be something, you know, new for all of us. I want to go back to market sentiment at the end of the year. It just felt like nothing could, you know, kind of move out of the doldrums and the negative tone of 2022. Has the tone changed? Have the fundamentals significantly changed here now that we're almost wrapping up the first month of 2023?
It's interesting. I mean, certainly we've seen a market shift downward in rates, as it looks like maybe we've seen peak inflation. So I think that's a bit of a relief point. Now, that could shock to the downside if we start to see data that suggests otherwise. If you're in the sort of Larry Summers camp, maybe the Larrian camp, well, we should do 50 because we haven't beaten up this inflation dragon yet. That could prove bearish if that sort of thesis becomes base case and reality in the months ahead. It's not our base case. I think if you look at M2 money supply growth, you look at supply chains, you look at, you know, some of the deterioration in general, you know, commodity deceleration. It seems as though the narrative of inflation decelerating is the actual reality. And the question is, where do we settle from here?
You mentioned that you think that the Fed could become much more accommodative in the second half of the year. What did you mean by that? What do you think they'll do?
Well, I think they'll have to take a look at the data, but if we look at the leading economic indicators, we look at retail sales, we look at home sale prices, we look at, you know, the general sort of increase in cost of funding, everything. One could argue that the economic picture may deteriorate further from here. So a pause, perhaps after the next 25 basis point hike, is possible. And could we see them cut rates this year? You know, your guess is as good as mine, but I think it's very much data dependent. And if inflation trends lower and data on the economic side deteriorates, I think it gives Fed wiggle room to cut rates at the end of the year or towards the end of the year.
Yeah, I do feel like we live from data point at this point. And we'll see what the Fed has to say next week when we get that first Fed decision of 2023. Hey, Aaron, thank you so much. Happy New Year from me as well. Aaron Kennan, co-founder, chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management. They've got approximately more than $1 billion in assets under management. He's joining us via Zoom from Stamford, Connecticut.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app,
TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live on Bloomberg Quick Take every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.